All right, today's July 8th, 1994, and my name's Annie Gilbert. I'm speaking with Dick and Migs Durrance. And I had a couple more specific questions than I think you've answered on the Aspen Historical Society videotape. And one set of them was for you, Mrs. Durrance, about competing in skiing as a woman. And I was wondering, how many women were racing when you started racing? About?
I think not more than about 30.
In the whole country?
Well, and that I ever competed with.
Uh-huh.
I was from the West, from California, and I think in the first state championships, or it might have been the second one, that I was only in one. And I think there were about six.
Uh-huh. And
when was that?
When was this about?
1937.
Uh-huh. And where, did you know them all beforehand?
No. No, I only knew a few.
Uh-huh.
A couple. I'm the ones who'd been to Yosemite.
Uh-huh. So were they from all over California, basically?
Mostly right around the Sierras.
Uh-huh. And why do you think... Well, I guess I should ask you, were there a lot more men competing at the same time than that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there were probably tenfold.
Uh-huh.
Would be a rough guess.
Uh-huh.
I'd say the women were, what, about a tenth at the most.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how would you explain that? Or
hard to explain.
It was a very new sport.
Uh-huh.
It was new, and the total number of men, of course, was very small too.
Mm-hmm.
So
when he started in the East, and I think the skiing was further along there than it was in California.
Oh yeah, it moved west, mm-hmm. just like the population moved west, and mm-hmm. not by covered wagon, but by
uh huh.
Well, then I went to Sun Valley the second year to race, and that was an east-west race, and that was more people. That was more like 35 ladies, I think.
Uh-huh. Well, see, part of me thinks that really that's a lot of women to be involved in a sport like skiing, you know? And then the other part of me thinks, well, if it's still just a tenth of the number of men who are competing, I'm not sure what to think about that, you know? And so I thought I'd ask you.
Well, it's something that's never come up, really. It was just accepted, I think, that it was primarily in the East where it got started, skiing got started early on. It was mostly in colleges, and most of the colleges that skied at that time were men's colleges.
Like Dartmouth, for example.
Like Dartmouth, Harvard, Princeton, Yale.
Uh-huh.
And the Ivy League primarily were the mm-hmm. people who had started, most of them had started, or a lot of them had started in Europe on just vacations, and then a lot of them started taking it up mm-hmm. at that time, but it was not, it was slow to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't get into the girls' colleges, and they were pretty separate.
Into Bennington it did.
Yeah, well, not very much. There weren't many, there were a few.
Nancy and Kathy.
And that was later
there.
On. That
was the next year.
Mm-hmm. Still in the 30s?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Was the sport different for women? Were there different rules or different... did you wear different kinds of clothes or have different equipment, anything like
no,
that?
We no, we raced the same courses
mm-hmm.
that the men did.
They were usually short. The downhills were shortened.
No, not then.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not until later.
Well, you said there's all a bunch of lies mm-hmm. anyway, right?
Yeah. Various opinions.
I remember the Harriman Cup when we raced and it started at the same place.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I won't argue with
how you. About how about raced. Skiing styles, you know, were
they were the same.
Yeah. I remember in the other interview you mentioned something, Mrs. Durrance, about working with Friedel Pfeiffer as a coach and how his coaching style was a little bit daunting in the beginning.
Very.
Why do you think that was, or
Well, I think he was an Austrian, and I was very new to the sport. I'd only started the year before.
Uh-huh.
And I had been in one race, which was the California Championships.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't win that. I think I got third. But I went to Sun Valley, and the girls who had raced in the 1936 Olympics were all there.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice Chair had brought Friedel over to train the ladies' team.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just a little daunted by some of the things we were told to do. I'd never skied things like that before.
Uh-huh.
I had not. Yosemite is a very small place, and little bitty hills. And all of a sudden, we were racing on things that were a whole mountain, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it was quite a startling experience.
Uh-huh.
For me.
But you became a daredevil, more or less, huh?
Well, I liked it.
Did you find anything in common with the other women on the team, or the women that you skied with?
Oh yes.
Like what, for instance?
Well, we all love to ski, and we all love to go into the Ram afterwards and have a beer and dance and so on. I mean, just the things young women like to do.
Uh-huh. Did you find that you all had started skiing for similar reasons or similar
circumstances? No, everybody, almost everyone, I guess everyone had started it before I did.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of one of the last to start on that group.
Uh-huh. And had they started with their families, or just were they general outdoors?
They started in Europe.
Oh, really?
Skiing in Europe, most of the girls had.
Uh-huh. On vacations with their folks?
You know them better than I did.
Alice Chair organized the ladies' team before the 1936 Olympics, and it was a hobby of hers to get the ladies going. And so she started them in Europe. She invited a couple of them to come over and join up with the group from Boston.
And some were there already.
And some were there already. And she got them going and decided that she wanted to see American women become competitive in the international field.
So Alice
Chair was really responsible for ladies becoming racers.
I mean,
the racing aspect of skiing.
Uh-huh.
But of course, there were ladies who were skiing for fun, just recreational skiing,
mm-hmm.
before that,
mm-hmm.
and they'd join their husbands or brothers or families,
mm-hmm.
and would ski wherever people were skiing, which was not all that widespread in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was the one that just decided she wanted to see American ladies or girls become competitive in the international field.
Hmm. So she found folks who were already skiing, women who were already skiing, or did she actually take some who she thought would have potential and teach them?
No, she didn't select them. They were skiers who, on their own,
uh-huh.
had become good enough to, in her opinion, to join the team.
Mm-hmm. So she found them.
She located them.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Do you think that the same kinds of things that people look up to in a male racer were also respected for women? I guess it doesn't matter.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Of course it did. I mean,
yeah.
There wasn't any distinction between men and women as far as desire to win or to be competitive and so on. And so if you were good beating the others, you became more famous.
Uh-huh.
So it was a competitive sport that men and women had the same goals and same aspirations that anyone would.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to respond to about that?
No, mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. Would you say there was a ski culture among skiers, a certain way of looking at the world or things that you like to do, something distinct from...
Like to ski.
besides that.
No, we weren't peculiar.
And it'd be pretty healthy because we always had to walk up the mountains that we skied down.
Uh-huh.
And we usually had to sidestep all the way up to, in order to pack out the course.
Uh-huh.
So they were all women and men who liked athletics and who were game to try things new.
Uh-huh.
And it was something quite new.
Uh-huh. What'd you do in the summer, generally?
Ride horses.
There wasn't, ski training didn't go through the full year. I mean, in the early days, it wasn't nearly as organized or as serious. Mm-hmm. It was more informal, and when the snow flew, then you went, got your skis out and went to ski races.
Mm-hmm. I think it was far more camaraderie, because it was a small group, and we all did have the same interests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just curious if there were similar summer sports that skiers were interested in.
Though I think everybody, together for, a couple of months out of the year.
Uh-huh. I was also curious, since you both have been so involved in the film world and the photography world, how important do you think films and photos have been in promoting young ski areas? Because I understand that you made a
ski areas?
Yeah.
Oh, I think film and photography, pictures instead of words, as opposed to words, say a lot for skiing and have been utilized a great deal to promote ski areas. In mm-hmm. other words, to show people what it's like there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people that can't come and magazines and so on utilize pictures as well as words to describe what's available.
Uh-huh. Now you made one or two movies for Sun Valley, is that right?
Well, let's see. I did, my first film was for Sun Valley. One was called Spring Ski Chase, and one was called Sun Valley Holidays.
Now, were those...
One was promotional, one was documentary.
Okay. So, for the promotional one, then, what kinds of things were you thinking about when you made that
film? We were showing everything that was there.
Uh-huh.
What kind of the ski school, the activities that went on there, and you tried to convey the idea that this was a great spot to take a vacation and incidentally learn to ski.
Uh-huh. So
so that was the main thing. However, it did show what went on there in the summer, which were the normal things that in the West could be classified as, ranch? I had the word, doesn't matter. In other words, the summer activities, like riding and climbing and fishing and so on, you showed everything that went on there year-round.
So Sun Valley was meant to be a year-round...
Sun Valley Holidays, it was a place to come take a holiday.
Uh-huh. So did you have a specific audience in mind when you made the film?
No, anybody that could afford it.
Okay. That makes sense. And then for your documentary, did you have a different...
Documentary, the film that I did was... pretty much a copy or used the model of the original ski chase that was done in Europe in the 20s by a fellow by the name of Funk. And he featured Hannes Schneider and Leni Riefenstahl in one of the ski chase films and used the Arlberg group of teachers and shot it right around San Antonio. And the story was simply a bunch of guys chasing another fellow and finally catching him.
Mm-hmm. And you were the one who got caught, is that right?
I played the part of the hare, the guy they chased, and we used all the ski teachers from Sun Valley after the ski season was over.
Uh-huh.
So it involved everything that you skied down, you climbed up. So there was a lot of climbing involved, and it took some time to do.
Uh-huh.
And it was shot, that first film, which was a documentary about a ski chase, was done in April, as I recall.
In 36 or 7?
No, 40.
Oh, 40, okay. 40. Now how about for Aspen? You also did some films for Aspen,
well,
is that right?
I was asked to run Aspen the second year it was in operation. It opened in January of the of
36. No, 46.
Yeah,
46.
It opened January 47, really. And that was the winter of 46, 47.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I came in October in 47.
Okay.
So the end of that year.
And you were general manager, is that right?
I was general manager, general everything. There were only just a handful of us that ran it.
Uh-huh.
I had one girl in the office, Elsa Fisher, and she did all the bookkeeping and made the payrolls and all that, wrote the checks. And then there was Red Rowland, who was in charge of the mountain, and he had been in charge of building them, and he was a fellow with broad experience in construction. And he'd worked on railroads and so on, so he knew the mechanics, and the others were all pickup people from local people who were miners originally, who had been here and or were born into mining families. And so it was only half a dozen or so of them, and so we were a very small operation.
Well, I have so many questions now, I don't know which one to say.
Well, take your time.
Well, let me stick
Tape's
with the...
cheap.
I know. Let me stick with the film questions. During your stay in Aspen in the 40s, did you make some films for them?
Yeah, the first one was in 48, I think. That was the second year I was here.
Okay.
And that was called Ski Time in Aspen.
And that was
that was Aspen in Winter, I beg your pardon.
And that was a promotional
film? That was a promotional film, and at that time the railroad was still coming in with freight. There weren't any passengers, except on special occasions. And there wasn't a heck of a lot going on here, and I featured in that film skiing by Friedel and Fred Islin. And Friedel had brought Fred over from Sun Valley. From Sun Valley. And so it showed Aspen as it was in the very beginning, in which there was a limited amount of skiing. There weren't many trails cut.
Two lifts?
And there were two lifts. There were two lifts that went to the top. One was made by the American Steel and Wire, who built the first lifts in this country in Sun Valley. And they built the lower lift, which is the longer one. And then the upper lift was made from spare parts from mining, old mining equipment, and was built by mining engineers, the Herron brothers. And it had its problems, since it was made out of pickup stuff. And but we had the two lifts that went to the top of the mountain at that time.
It took 45 minutes to get up.
Well, it's probably less time than hiking, right?
Yeah. A hell of a lot better than walking.
So when you were making this film with Fred Islin and Friedel Pfeiffer, what kinds of things were you trying to show about Aspen?
We were showing everything that went on in Aspen. It was a promotional film to entice people to come, to make them aware of what was here, that we existed, and that we provided ski instruction as well as good skiing, as good as it was in those days, and better than most places.
So what kinds of things do you think were Aspen's best selling points at that time?
I think the fact that it was a town that was informal, had excellent snow, it was reliable snow came, and snow was as good as you could find. We were at an elevation that pretty much guaranteed good snow and good skiing, since the town itself is about 8,000, and there weren't many places in those days that high or that reliable. Alta was a little higher, but there was no veil at that time. And so we featured the fact that we had good skiing, good snow, and good instruction, and fairly decent accommodations and food. Fairly.
Not many of them.
In those years, it seems like European instructors like Friedel Pfeiffer and Fred Islin were strong selling points for areas in the United States. Would you agree with that?
In Aspen, no. That wasn't that was true in the East, the very first areas in the East.
And in Sun Valley.
In the beginning. In the East. It was Mittersill, Franconia, and places like that where a few Austrians and Swiss had come over and it started the first small ski schools there. And then when Harriman built Sun Valley in 1936, he got a fellow named Felix Schofgotsch, who was a count from Salzburg, to arrange to have a bunch of Austrians from Salzburg in their Austrian jackets and everything else. And so they started having European-type ski schools. Now, this was not the Auberg method. I mean, it was Auberg method, which is simply the snowplow method. And then a few years later, Friedel came in and started up again with Austrians, but it got to the point where they had to hire Americans too. And when he came to Aspen, I would say there was a predominance of American ski teachers, mm-hmm. not of Austrian ski teachers. Mm-hmm. So
he was the only one.
No,
Fred was Swiss.
Fred was Swiss, yeah.
But all
European.
The rest were Americans.
European.
Yeah. Yeah. And then later Stein Erickson, right?
Many years later.
Well, what I was thinking is that because skiing developed as a sport in Europe before in America, and because of the Auberg method and the things that Hannes Schneider had developed in Austria, I was thinking that American ski areas, early ski areas, tried to draw connections to Europe in order to boost their reputation or to give them a feeling of legitimacy.
No,
I don't think that's right.
I don't think that's true. Yeah. They simply drew on people who knew how to do it.
Uh-huh.
And they were the ones who knew how.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they came from Switzerland, Austria, or even some from this country.
I never even heard about the Auberg technique.
Well, I was thinking more of the names, you know, Friedel Pfeiffer and Fred Islin.
Well,
Friedel came over to coach the ladies' team.
Uh-huh.
And then I think for the next year he taught at Sun Valley. But then the war came along and that stopped everything.
Mm-hmm. About Aspen, the place, what drew you here? I know that you came in 41 for a race.
Yeah, right? That was a national downhill and slalom.
Right, and then the Aspen Ski Company invited you here to work on the
later. We were partners with James Laughlin at Alta. We had talked him into going to Alta when we were both married and in Sun Valley.
Uh-huh.
And I had been Jim Laughlin.
This man.
In New Zealand and Australia in 1937, the summer of 37. And when we had skied at Alta, and we'd skied at Aspen, and while we were in Sun Valley, we realized that Alta had real potentials.
Uh-huh.
And so we talked Jim into coming up with enough money to finish building the Alta Lodge.
Uh-huh.
And in return for doing that, the Salt Lake City Winter Sports Association, a group of businessmen in Salt Lake, who had already thought that they would try to, they had talked the Denver Rio Grande into putting up $25,000 to build a lodge, but that wasn't enough money. And so they were sort of stuck with that, but they had a homemade built chairlift made out of, again, out of mining materials. And so Jim agreed that that would be pretty good, and he and I were close, and we'd been together for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided right after we got married that we would like to go to Alta and start our own resort.
Uh-huh. What was it about Alta that made you think it had such potential?
Most fabulous snow in the country. It still has.
Yeah, better than Colorado snow?
Yeah.
Well, it gets a ton of snow. It just so happens that it's geologically situated so that it catches the western storms that get over the desert. And they're sort of sucked up into Little Cottonwood Canyon, into the Wasatch Mountains, and forced to snow. So you do get, for the Rocky Mountains, you get as much snow there as you do anywhere, if not more.
Oh, more.
And it's usually dry snow because it's at the base of Alta is 8,700 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it goes up to close to 10. And so you don't have huge runs, but you do have lots of dry snow and lots of avalanches.
Uh-huh. Did you have problems with that?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. They still have problems with avalanches closing the access to Alta from Salt Lake City, because it's a 4,000-foot climb up from Salt Lake to Alta, and it's on a steep road that has gully after gully of where snow at the top comes rushing down, and you get lots of avalanches across the road. Mm-hmm. And they close the road because the highway crews don't like to take a chance on getting caught.
Mm-hmm. Now they blow them down and it's not as dangerous, but that wasn't heard of at the time.
Yeah. Did you have avalanche problems in the ski area too?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of them. There were lots of steep gullies. There's a lot of steep skiing all through Alta, except for the upper basin, which is fairly simple and not too steep.
I think anywhere where you have good skiing, you're going to have an avalanche problem.
Avalanches and skiing go together.
Yeah.
So if the snow, the amount of snow and the quality of snow was Alta's best thing, what other characteristics made
it? It was our own. Uh-huh. It was starting something of your own. Uh-huh. In other words, we at least, I think we at that time thought that we could run a ski school that was a little different than the European type ski school. Mm-hmm. And it was more a friendly type. And our opinion, well, my opinion was that ski technique wasn't all that complicated and could be fairly simple and could be taught in simple terms and not as dogmatically as the Europeans wanted everybody to believe. And so it was starting something new, a new ski school in a ski area, and we were gung-ho for skiing.
So what were your impressions of Aspen then?
Go ahead.
Should I pause?
No, go ahead.
What were your impressions of Aspen and the valley when you came here, as far as landscape and snow and all that stuff goes?
No, this is Dick. Dave?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he just walked in. And so, hold on.
Hi. Who's Dave? Yes.
What were our impressions of Aspen when we first came? It was muddy.
It was a run-down
old town. It was a run-down old town. And the Hotel Jerome had one little light bulb that came down in the lobby. It was saw horses for tables. And,
How about the landscape, though, and the snow and skiing in comparison with Alta?
That's why we're here. That's why everybody came. Because the mountains surrounding Aspen were fantastic. Again, it was high. It's 8,000, roughly. In the valley, and they go up to 12,000 and 14,000. So it was well suited to skiing, and the town itself had a great deal of charm. I mean, for young people who wanted to come here and start a new life, whether it was to start a family or to find a family, build a family, whatever, and there was a lot of excitement about being sort of pioneers in a small town that had a history, but the history wasn't important. It was the skiing that drew all the people here.
Mm-hmm. Everybody knew everybody else. It was a little town.
There was a community spirit at the time because it was small. You did know it. You didn't have to lock your doors. You didn't have to lock anything. And if you left your ski coat that you rode up the lift on overnight at the bottom of the lift,
it would still be there.
It would still be there. And we went to Europe and never locked the front door.
We got to find a key. Yeah.
So it was a lot of camaraderie, I guess you'd call it. Everybody felt like they belonged together and were starting something that was exciting.
So you're speaking of a community of mostly young skiers.
Well, there was it was divided.
Music too.
The old timers were here. Yeah. People who had been born here, who had worked here, who had lived here, and had lived through the mining days.
Right.
And they'd stuck it out and stayed here, and either they became farmers, or they subsisted.
Uh-huh. Or you said that a few of them became involved with the ski company, building lifts and things
that's
like
right.
that.
A few of them.
Uh-huh.
Not many.
And then Walter came about the same time, Walter Petke, and he...
Yeah. He
started a completely different thing. I mean, there was skiing in the summer, in the winter, and in the summer, Walter started the cultural part of it.
Yeah, I'm just not sure he's gotten...
He started a thing called the Aspen Company, and then the other groups started the Aspen Skiing Corporation. Corporation. And Walter's brother-in-law, Pussy's brother, Paul Knitson, was sort of raised the money to get the lifts and so on in. Mm-hmm. And Walter was buying land and starting the Goethe Bicentennial and all, and the music festival, things like that. But in order to buy, if you wanted to buy stock in the Aspen Company, you also had to buy stock in the Skiing Corporation. If you wanted to buy stock in the Skiing Corporation, you also had to buy it in the Aspen Company.
Do you know how long that lasted, that rule? Or?
That lasted,
probably 10 years.
I was going to say the first 10 years.
So there's a very strong financial connection between...
Oh, very strong, yeah. It was really... a town could not survive very well on one or the other. Mm-hmm. It took both.
Mm-hmm. Year-round
operation. It had to be year-round operation, with the exception of a few terrible months.
The bud season.
And
the delightful fall season, which the weather was good and the colors were good and quiet.
Yeah. So when you made films for Aspen, did you also talk about the music and the culture in order to promote the area?
Oh, yeah.
It's always been the two together.
Mm-hmm. That's Aspen is... combination of skiing in the winter and
I think it was the first resort to do that.
Mm-hmm. So that would make it, that's one of the reasons
it
why it's distinct.
Made it unique among other ski areas.
Uh-huh.
And why it was so attractive to young people and to older people too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it was worthwhile to be here year round. You could make a living year round because of where people coming from.
Uh-huh.
Grocery stores, gas stations, whatever it takes to make a community work.
Yeah. How would you compare the skiing in Aspen to places in the East and places in Europe that you ski?
Well, I haven't skied much in the East. I don't like the snow there. There was no reason to, if you lived in the West, I don't know why anyone would go East to ski.
Money goes to the bank.
Well, yeah, there's that.
I've made a very facetious remark.
No, lots of people agree. I grew up in the East. I asked, how would you compare the skiing in Aspen to the East and the places that you've skied in Europe and maybe other places you've skied in the West, like Alta?
And what devilry did you come up with?
I said, if you've lived here, there was no reason to go East.
Right. That's true. If you live here, you've got skiing as good as you find anywhere.
Mm-hmm. We did go to Europe, and we lived there for many years, and we skied all over Europe, too.
That doesn't mean it isn't just as good in Europe. No.
It was a lot more crowded.
Mm-hmm. More crowded in Europe?
Oh, much more crowded.
And this was in the 40s and 50s, is that right?
50s and 60s.
50s and 60s, okay. How else would you compare the skiing in Europe to the skiing in Aspen? Is the snow similar?
Well, I think for quite some time, Aspen developed a reputation for taking good care of the slopes. At first, before we had mechanical grooming, we had a trail crew that had, with shovel and skis, would pack out the slopes and keep the runs in good shape. And year after year, we'd cut more and more runs. And we were more concerned with the a skier as an athlete, as a guy who really wanted to ski rather than to partake of the social or life. In other words, mm-hmm. skiing was paramount here. Mm-hmm. In the European resorts, it's sort of a combination of people who like to sit in the sun and who like to hike and who are not necessarily great skiers. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was that mix. We didn't have much of that mix here in Aspen. In the winter, it was really, you skied or you didn't come.
Mm-hmm. I'll do it this time.
Would you say that that's still true today?
Not necessarily, no. I think a lot of people come today because they want to be seen here. And yeah. Their friends come, and they couldn't care less about the skiing.
Uh-huh. Even
the
yes.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to do besides ski now.
Uh-huh. I was thinking that.
Let me ask it. That's
Halvor
Kleppen. Yeah.
Here, let's start this.
What? Oh no!
How many broken legs have you had?
About the same leg 4 times.
Okay.
In the same place?
It's too close to lunchtime.
Wow! And skiing always.
Well, we usually eat around noon.
You broke it when you were skiing.
Well, one time. It was done in the hospital because they didn't set it right.
Oh, okay.
So a year later, they had to re-break it.
Oh.
Okay. We'll do it then.
So I was out for 2 years.
Uh-huh. But one of the things that interests me is how skiers' attitudes about adventure and danger and whatever have changed over the years. And it seemed like in the early years, people just went and had fun, and if they broke a leg, well, that was just what happened, you know? Would you say
I think that depends on how badly you do it.
Yeah.
There are broken legs, and there are broken legs.
That's true.
Well, I think that it varies with who it is. In other words, some people take it as part of life. If you want to be a skier, you may.
And
take,
other people quit.
Yeah, and other people aren't really of that mind.
Uh-huh.
And so it's the individual, really. Mm-hmm. It's not a trend at all. In other words, it wasn't everybody at that time was gung-ho and I'll break a leg to hell with it. And today they cry their eyes out if they break a leg. I think that's just, you can't generalize on the attitude of the people that come. Mm-hmm. It's a more varied group that do come now. Rather than the young, energetic, adventurous types that were here in the early days. Now we get a mix of old people who couldn't care less if they ever ski and wouldn't think of risking anything. And you get the young people who risk twice as much as we did in the old days.
Mm-hmm. There are also a lot of older people who come ski here.
Yeah, and have been skiing for a long time, and they keep coming. And, mm-hmm. There's one thing about skiing is that you can do it until you croak.
Yeah, and families on vacation,
and
too.
Families on vacation is a great family sport. Mm-hmm. It's a great thing for the family to take up. And nowadays you can...
That's next, sir.
Oh, you can separate the kids so that they're playing with other kids and they have their own thing to do and the parents can go do their thing.
Mm-hmm. When you were working as general manager in Aspen, what kinds of concerns did you have? I know one of them was promoting the area, which got you involved with the 1950 FIS. Mm-hmm. What other kinds of issues were you coping with then?
Well, the main issue was making money. Mm-hmm. I mean, it had
making it easier, too.
Well, to make money, you had to get more people. To get more people, you had to make it easier.
Make what easier? The skiing?
Skiing.
Okay.
And so in order to make it easier, you had to have money. So, there you go. It's a vicious circle that you have to go through. And that's why I got the idea of having the world championships here, because they'd never been held in this country. And I had raced in Europe, and I was aware that this, compared to the European ski courses and championship courses, and we definitely were qualified to put on a world championship, and all we had to do was to get the powers that be, which were in Europe, to agree that it would be worth trying.
Uh-huh.
And so we promoted that idea in order to get more people to come, to bring more money into town, and also to improve the skiing here.
Uh-huh.
And so one went hand in hand with the other.
So you wanted to use the extra income in order to develop the ski area and then attract more people again after
that? All that worked together. In other words, to have the World Championships, you had to have good skiing, had to have good courses. That meant that you had to have raised money to build those new courses.
Right.
And that's what we did. We got contributions from people who were interested in seeing this part of Colorado become good. It was mostly Colorado money that put on the World Cups.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was not ski money. I mean, there weren't skiers. These were the Coors Company, the Brewing Company, the power companies, and so on.
Banks,
and people like that, and rich people
who
had money. And they thought this is an excellent way to improve the image of Colorado as far as a tourist economy.
Huh.
And they wanted the tourist economy to grow in Colorado. It had the potential.
Mm-hmm.
And all they had to do was start spending some money and developing areas so that they would be attractive to outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick designed these beautiful trails like Ruthie's Run and Gypsy Doodle, all those runs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was
ones that he designed and cut out because he knew what would make a good ski run.
What does make a good ski run?
What does make a good ski run? Number one, space, room.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like ski through trees, so you got to have open space so you can make turns and not bump into something.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's number one, and then it has to be interesting. It can't just be
that's
flat.
To follow the terrain.
It has to be the terrain. You have to utilize the terrain, whatever gullies and bumps and the variety of terrain that you've got on the mountain, but you mostly have to allow space, because in the early days, the trails in the east were maybe 10, 20 feet wide. Well, you hardly had room to snowplow, much less to make turns. Certainly, you didn't do any traversing. And so we wanted to give them room to traverse if they wanted to come to a stop, and so on. So we built runs like Ruthie's Run, which could be used for the World Championships, but also would enhance the skiing for the average skier, for the beginning skier. And we had to have runs that appealed to people who were taking up the sport, who weren't particularly good at it, but their dollars were just as good as anyone else's.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any general philosophies about development or building trails? Or was it just every year you tried to build a few more trails? Or
well, the philosophy was simply to make more.
So bigger is better always?
Well, not bigger is better, but more space. The mountain was big enough to accommodate more ski runs.
You could also scatter people better.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't all come down the same little trail.
Mm-hmm. You had to have a variety and a number of different runs to accommodate more people.
Uh-huh. And the ski company, did they have any land ownership problems or anything like that with cutting new trails? Do you remember?
Well, we weren't so serious about getting Forest Service approval or anybody else's approval about cutting trails in those days.
They didn't care.
Nobody gave it a second thought. And so we didn't ask. And we figured that the only way to do it was don't ask, just do it. That's how it worked out.
Uh-huh.
And it was many years before all of a sudden you had people who said, my God, they're cutting trees down.
Uh-huh.
And they shouldn't dare do that. The elk or the deer might not like it. Uh-huh. We didn't
get that. But that's only in the last couple of years.
That's a group of people who have come in after the skiers. In the beginning, the only thing that we were all interested in was making the mountains good to ski on.
Mm-hmm.
And anything else was secondary, such as ownership, such as wildlife, such as, I don't know.
A lot of the Aspen Mountain was mining claims that Darcy and his family owned a lot of them.
A lot of people owned them, and we had a lawyer in Denver who did nothing but trace in the courthouse who owned the rights, the surface rights, to a lot of the mining claims. There's the surface rights and the mining rights, in other words, underground, overground. And so either they bought the surface rights from people who maintained and kept the mining rights. There weren't many because mining had gone fluid when they went off the silver standard. So you did try to find that, but the upper third of the mountain, roughly, is Forest Service, and the lower two-thirds were owned by private individuals who had mining claims. They were mining claims, essentially.
And the ski company ended up buying them out?
They bought them. They at least bought surface rights,
right?
If not total rights. Mm-hmm. Many of them, it was hard to tell who owned them. The records were not good, and so it was a question of quit claiming a lot of the land. In other words, going to court and say, nobody owns this, so I hereby announce that I own it. And so you paid whatever the back taxes were, and so much of the property that people built on in town and all around were quit claimed, going through the courts, and since nobody laid claim to that land, it was yours. And so there was that process, plus, of course, trying to find living owners and offering them money for it.
So the ski company had a lawyer in Denver working on this.
Yep.
They had you running the show, pretty much.
In the very beginning, yeah.
And
well, they had a board of directors.
Yeah, it was a corporation run by a board of directors. Most of them were in Denver. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of voluntary. Didn't pay anything, and they were interested skiers, essentially, and businessmen. So they knew what had to be done. They were aware of the fact that we needed money to run it.
And many of them bought up some of the old houses to have for a place to come to when they'd come over here.
For anyone who had money in those days, it was a feast. you could come and if you had the money, you could buy a lot of property for very little money. But 99% of the people who came here didn't have even that little bit of money.
Right.
And so it was the people with money that eventually ended up owning the property.
Now, I understand that you were also involved in A-Basin, is that right?
Well, I was part of the group that started it, yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
A-Basin?
Yeah,
well, Larry jumped. Had the idea, and Thor Groswald, and
Jarvis Schaufler,
and Sandy Schaufler. They were two brothers who went to one of the Ivy League schools.
By Williams,
no, well, it doesn't matter. I forget. Amherst. They went to Amherst, and there were about five or six of us who decided that we would apply. That was Forest Service land. We would apply to the Forest Service for a permit to build a ski area. One that was reasonably close to Denver and high enough so that it had good snow. It was right at, it was above and below timberline. So it was a good ski area. It was, there was a problem that it was on the other side of Loveland Pass, and so you had to cross the pass to get to it. But then it was good snow and it was possible to do it. It was really Larry Jump's idea. And he and the Schaufler brothers.
And you helped them get the permit?
Well, Thor Groswell and I were in business together. I was working for Thor at the ski company making skis.
And this was about when? I forget.
It must have been 46.
Okay.
After the war, right after the war.
Okay. And then so you and Thor...
well, we all got together, and Larry and the Schaufler brothers actually went up there and ran it, and they got what's his name, the guy?
Willie Sheffler?
No, we fell down below it.
Oh,
Dirkham had been in worked with the Forest Service back in Pennsylvania, and he came over and he joined up the group too.
Okay.
And but he bought the homestead down in Keystone. And made a fortune out of selling out to Keystone and that development. So he did well. I never made a nickel. I got $1 worth of stock. I guess I still have it somewhere. But we did it just because we were friends and were interested in seeing more ski areas. We had no grandiose ideas that anybody was going to get rich. Mm-hmm. We were just trying to get enough money to build some lifts.
Mm-hmm. So folks from Denver could come and have something.
For people for Denver. Uh-huh. It was a weekend resort.
So it had a different character.
It's a day area.
Uh-huh. As compared to Aspen, would
no
you
lodging,
say?
No lodging, no housing.
Oh.
Yeah.
You just drove up during the day and skied.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm trying to think. Did I ask you about the skiing in Europe and if the skiing in Aspen is better than that, or I can't remember if we finished that.
I think
that
you
course.
Did ask us, and we did say that European skiing, they cared, there was more of a mix, and they weren't as concerned with the skier per se, such as improving the snow conditions, like
That's right.
grooming and fixing up the ski area.
They'd be different now. We haven't been there for...
Well, we're only talking about those days, those early days, the days that we were there.
Yeah.
We can't say a word about what's going on now.
Well, you can.
All we know is what people say they went there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't think of anything else. Thank you so much
If you think of anything,
give
a holler and we'll
Okay.
try to answer it.
Great.